gotta know. If you're trying to waste my time, go.
I'm dropping off the laundry earlier. I'm like, what am I doing on Memorial Day weekend recording a podcast indoors in front of the computer? But here we are. We do what we have to do so the content gets made, right? The content isn't going to make itself, and John Jay College isn't going to promote its work itself. So here we all are. With that being said, I think that's a good place to introduce you and the show. Welcome to the Antifada. This is Sean. This is a special episode that we've set up with our friend, co-founder within the Independent Labor Club of New York. That is Cyrus Capo. So, Cyrus, thank you so much for setting up this special episode. We are with two teachers at CUNY John Jay College. We have with us Ian Seda, who is an associate professor, and we have Carolyn Heater, who is the substitute lecturer at John Jay College, to talk today about the student protests recently that have been going on, the larger struggles within the City University of New York today, and of course, stretching back decades. And also, as an alumnus of the university, they're both going to go back and grade some of my old papers on history and give me ruthless critiques about what I had wrong 20-something years ago. That last part isn't actually going to happen. Without further ado, welcome Ian and Carolyn to the show. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
This has been an incredible spring semester, I must say, at American universities. We've seen an outpouring of protest, demonstration, and struggle, and arrests, of course, backlash from police and university authorities, not just at CUNY, but across the country, and in a sense across the world, due to the ongoing atrocities that are going on in Gaza. So we're going to touch on that, obviously, in the second half of the episode. But what I'd like to do first is have both of you introduce yourselves individually, the work that you do, and then we'll talk a little bit about John Jay and CUNY, and then we'll go out to the protest. Does that sound good?
Excellent.
Sounds good.
Excellent. All right, Carolyn, let's start with you. Talk a little bit about your work, how you ended up at John Jay, and your background in activism and politics and that good stuff.
Yeah, well, I first came to John Jay through the master's program in economics. I studied anthropology in my undergraduate, and I was, you know, interested in investigating the world. And found the economics department through my friend Henry, who had just formed in 2016. And so, I went through the master's program and I graduated and I began teaching in the department the following year. And I'm mostly interested in nonprofits and philanthropy and kind of their intersection with education and healthcare, and so funding higher education institutions and also K-12 public schools and healthcare. And so like the care economy and philanthropy and how it impacts that. I'm also a musician.
Oh, nice. So, let's take this opportunity right up at the top. Carolyn reminded me in the beginning that if you're in the New York City area on June 8th, at the People's Garden in Bushwick, you're throwing a musical event. Is that right?
Yeah, there's going to be a show. It's going to be the department open to the public. A lot of professors in the department are in bands and former students from the master's program. And so we're going to have about 5 bands. We're going to have some speakers. There will be barbecue and food and general frivolity. It's on June 8th at the People's Garden in Bushwick. So at
2 p.m.
You've
kind of alighted upon, I think, one of the interesting things that we're doing in this episode, which is highlighting a recent program that you're both in, the economics program at John Jay College, which is, as I understand it, as Cyrus has told me, like largely a Marxist department. Like you're quietly doing a lot of political economy and doing a lot of analysis, as you said, on NGOs and the U.S. economy and the global economy. So what was it that drew you to this, and like, and in what capacity are you teaching political economy in the department?
Well, yeah, what I learned about economics, it's like, and Ian can speak to this as well. Coming from an anthropology background, it's like anthropology builds pluralism into discipline. It's like you know, it's very self-aware. It had to kind of contend with itself because it has this very weird past and just the origins of the discipline itself. But economics doesn't have that same reflexivity. It's like very much the King's language. A lot of important decisions get made according to like these theories, economic ideas, ways, you know, ideas around the mechanisms that sort of govern the economy. But it's not as self-reflective and pluralist as other disciplines. But there is, you know, that being said, there are plenty of other people who disagree with the mainstream in terms of economic thought. Schools that takes a radical political economy approach to studying the economy.
So it would be going too far then to say that it's a Marxist department, but it's heterodox, largely heterodox economic department.
I don't think it would be going too far to say that. Maybe I'm being too tame in my description. I don't know, Ian, you want to chime in?
Yeah, why don't you chime in, Ian, and introduce yourself as well?
Well, first of all, I like more the label of radical political economy than heterodox economics, definitely. So in my case, I've been at John Jay now for 11 years. Wow, 11 years. And I had the luck of doing my graduate work at one of those departments that precisely expands radical political economy, the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. It has a 50-year tradition, 51-year tradition of that focus on economics.
Wolf and Resnick, too, were the two big ones, right?
Wolf, Resnick, Bowles, Gintis, many, many important names mm-hmm. we might want at some point. But personally, in my case, economics made an entrance into my interest, like in my I think my last year of my undergrad, when I was taking an elective on a course called Business Cycles. And I don't know, I like history and I like numbers. And that class was in terms of graphs, equations, data, and history. And at the same time, certain names were mentioned by the professor, names like Kondratiev or Trotsky or Barbus. And I was like, whoa, wait, what is this? And of course, the thing that caught my eye was this attempt at trying to understand something that seems to be very fragile, uneven, ever-changing. So that definitely got me. Then once I decided to continue pursuing studies, I learned that there are actually departments that focus on political economy and the importance of history, sociology, and other disciplines that are usually not taken seriously by economics. And to my great luck, at UMass Amherst, participated in politicalism within the university, outside of it, and the students that department drew or still draws, like they had this unwritten rule that 50% of students have to come from other countries, half of them have to be female. I just learned so much way more from the other students than from the faculty, even though the faculty loves to believe that they are the important ones. So I got so enthralled by it. And in my particular case, I'm not a musician, but I'm super interested in music. My advisors in that case, Resnick and Wolf, are very open, you know, do something related to the music industry, stuff like that. But the thing is that I actually come from Puerto Rico. Mm. And that's the real reason I went to UMass to study. So this music thing was a little sidetrack, you know, hobby. So when I came here to New York City, I found myself reconnected with my origin. Work, let's say, on the socioeconomic crisis of the islands, a colony of the U.S. And, you know, New York City is the biggest town of Puerto Rico, so you can imagine how much space there is for these discussions.
Oh, yeah.
Which have a long historical trajectory, as you probably know. And thanks to the help of a dear friend who works with us, who hopefully you can have in this podcast at some point, Geert Dunt, who's the current chair of the department, he recruited me in 2013, and since then we have built up the undergraduate program, expanded to a master's program, and dealt with all the tribulations and problems that brings. But I can certainly say that this position, for me at least, is one that has opened up lots of doors in terms of connecting with communities here in New York City, trying to do work related to the Puerto Rican situation and how the diaspora wants to remain connected with the island and stuff like that. And in terms of broader themes, I'm interested, of course, in Marxian, you know, economic theory and stuff like that, as most of us are. So when you spoke about our Marxian economics department, I think it's fair to say that all of us, irrespective of what position we take, we bounce off our ideas out of the works of Marx. There's no doubt about it. Absolutely no doubt about it.
Well, you're making John Jay column very, very attractive. It's filled with like cool people who play music, and they're also not even heterodox. They're radical, and they're making connections with like actual struggles on the ground. So I can't think of a better endorsement of the program than what you've given. Let me backtrack a second and talk a little bit about the crisis in Puerto Rico, right? Let's take a little bit of time for that. We were there a couple of years ago, my partner and I, and I think at that moment, there you'll have to remind me because it's been a bit, but there's like a debt authority, right? Like Puerto Rico is under receivership, and while we were there, they were in the process of privatizing the electrical system on the island, and this was soon after the big hurricane. So talk a little bit about what Puerto Rico is facing right now, what the kind of like neoliberal or post-neoliberal austerity state is, and how that's being fought.
Mm-hmm. So for many decades, Puerto Rico was seen as a beacon and of rapid industrialization and supposedly economic development meant. That's how we appeared in the list, especially taking into account the context of the Cold War. So, you know, in the context of the Caribbean, you know, mix and match, compare Cuba and Puerto Rico in the context of Europe, Eastern and Western Europe. So that ideological fight. Was there economic growth and capitalist accumulation? Absolutely. Did it provide or satisfy the needs of the masses of the population? Well, of course, totally questionable, as in any other country. What's clear is that since the 1970s, when we had our first post-war fiscal crisis, the performance, even in capitalist terms, has not been the most appealing or successful. So, for example, in all of those decades, unemployment, just to use a standard measure that economists love to use, unemployment has been basically in double digits all for except 3 or 4 years. And I'm talking about 50 years, 50-year time span. Growth rates are meager. What basically gives us some basis of growth is a huge transfer of federal funds. So the management of those funds is something that's part of the political economy of the island. That's what the elites are interested in. Where, in what pockets that money is going to end up. And we also have this economic model in place in which the state basically provides a red card capital by providing all types of preferential treatment, tax. It works like a tax haven. So it's not a coincidence that right now we're suffering an immense fiscal crisis, right? The coffers of the government are now focused on repaying debt. And all the management of those discussions is guided by the hand, as you mentioned, of a fiscal control board that was both imposed by the U.S. government, but also elements of the elites actively interceded for that to happen, thinking that a fiscal control board might make more efficient the extraction of wealth of the economy for their own interests. So that's where we are right now. So with a fiscal control board, any slight attempt to talk about democracy in the colony has completely evaporated. Mm-hmm. People have done that for decades. But that has also provided a very fertile ground in terms of people understanding that politics and political economy cannot be merely understood in terms of a relationship between the U.S. and Puerto Rico, where Puerto Ricans without distinction are victims of U.S. colonialism and imperialism. And remember, like in any other crisis, there are groups that benefit, and we have local elites, the local bourgeoisie, capitalist class, some of its elements that have benefited. We have official data that speaks to this. So just to give you an example, economists use this thing called the functional distribution of income that basically measures the income that comes out of your effort laboring or the flow of income that comes on the basis of things that you might own, property. So on the one side, you have flows of income based, let's say, on wages. And on the other one, you have flows of income based on profits and interest and rents. When you look at the flow of income based on wages, since the crisis started, it's basically stagnant, flat, depending on how you measure and when you start, when you think that the crisis started. But in the best case scenario, it has increased in all of these years 3%, whereas the income going to this property claims, again, interest, rent, and profits, has gone up by 57%.
Wow.
So there's a huge redistribution of income, which has been very well covered. Right now, according to some, we're one of the most unequal countries in the world, in the top 10. Poverty here is around three times that of the U.S. So in the U.S., I think the last measurement was like 14%. In Puerto Rico, it's over 40%. Wow. Poverty, all of those things have combined to huge immigration. Immigration that is basically depleting the island. And you keep adding and up, and you see that, you know, different groups are going to suffer the adjustment of the crisis in different ways. And they, of course, intercede politically, electorally, and, you know, the usual stuff. So thankfully, I guess this is the last point I'll make for now, is that the understanding of politics and its manifestation in the electoral ground has changed, where people are noticing that, yeah, solving the colonial situation is maybe a necessary but not a sufficient answer to the problems of the masses. And we know that because we can gain independence tomorrow through whatever way, and the same ruling elites might be in place and the same economic model might be in place. So that's something that has slowly picked up discussions within it, and politically it has manifested in this alliance between necessarily agree in terms of the political status of the island, but they know that the problem is the two-party system and the socioeconomic interest behind those two parties that, you know, promote difference among themselves. One of them believes in statehood, the other one believes in the perpetuation of the colony. But what's constant throughout is the amount of benefits that they give the local capitalist elites. So when you start looking through that grid of the class structure of the island, you start understanding things differently in terms of potential solutions. And again, people are reacting to that. And for the first time in many decades, if we reduce politics for a second to the electoral arena, this election in November is a contested one, where usually the main parties would win with 45, 46, 47% of the vote. And now they are in 30s.
Interesting. So there's
and the last election, they almost lost the capital.
So there's a delegitimization.
There's a lot of frustrations with the alliance, as with any alliance, and the limits of the view, or where do we stop pointing fingers at and stuff like that. But again, it's a very, very fertile ground for political activism and a change in understanding.
Fertile ground indeed. Carolyn, I'm going to jump back to you here. You teach on global political economy, on global capitalism. Where would you situate, just as an example, the situation in Puerto Rico that Ian is talking about within like the larger changes of the global capitalist economy, or ways in which that global capitalist economy is being similarly delegitimated throughout the world right now?
Well, I mean, it's like, you know, there's sometimes it's the graph that shows like global GDP just being like a measure of economic output. And then, you know, you see the size of different economies and compared to the US and how the US is by far the powerhouse. And so it's like trying to understand. I mean, I think a big part of it is trying to break out of this idea that capitalism is natural, develop according to some kind of like meritocracy or like progress or ascendancy, but instead there's a system of domination that's in play always. And from a global perspective, it's like, you know, and from a development perspective, these other countries, that web, you can't separate, you know, you can't depoliticize economics and say it's just kind of accident that, you know, the economy is developing this way. It's like everything is always so intensely connected to this notion of, yeah, the capitalist elites and who is benefiting from whatever political movements or developments are happening in any country at any given time and orchestrating it. Mm-hmm.
And so let's then to the goings on in the Middle East, in the Levant, specifically in the occupied Palestinian territories. I'm sure both of you have a lot to say about what's going on, but let's look at this maybe from like a developmental perspective, right? It seems as though one of the headlines for us Marxists over the last 20, 25 years is the exclusion of Palestinian labor from the Israeli economy. And the reasons for that are manifold. But we have now a situation in Gaza which could be likened to a colonial enterprise, or at least like the subjugation, the domination of the people of Gaza, the blockade of Gaza leads to an unequal development that has an intense character that in a lot of places is maybe more submerged. So talk about your work, either of you, maybe we'll go with Ian first, as related to what's going on specifically in Gaza and occupied Palestine at the moment.
Well, in our case, Puerto Rico and Palestine have a long tradition of sharing this of liberation, while also actively trying to precisely free ourselves. So just to give you an example, one of our most important political activists in Puerto Rico, for years, the same, you probably, Sean, you remember when they put the second time that they put a Puerto Rican flag on the Statue of Liberty some years ago?
I think I do remember that, yes.
Yeah, so this activist of ours, who is known by the name of Tito Kayak, has multiple times traveled both to Palestine and Israel. You know, he has climbed Israeli towers, security towers, and put Palestinian flags and like that. But this is just a reflection of a long tradition of anti-colonial struggle that is right now in its most evident manifest form with what's happening there with the tens of thousands of deaths, which in that sense separates our experience. Puerto Rico was basically, or the attempt was made to absorb it into the U.S. culture, whereas in, and it had a strategic purpose in the Cold War, whereas in Palestine, you have the geopolitics of it, the access to resources, energy-wise, water-wise, etc., the relationship between the Palestinian working class and the limit of its opportunities in Israel, the whole settler colonialism, where this, you're literally trying to displace populations while at the same time intervening to make the populations feel good about the persons who are displacing them. So in that sense, I think this is just yet another symptom of the catastrophic times in which we live in, where I think it's fair to say that capitalism's time is approaching an end. The only problem is that we don't know if that end is going to take us all with it. And in terms of how that is manifesting right now in New York City, as you know, there were all these encampments, which many people have reconnected to the struggles of the 60s when there was another big crisis. And as I like to say, and maybe I don't know if both Caroline or you agree with this, but in this particular case, maybe it's easier to point the enemy. And it's global Zionism, I will say. Global Zionism as a manifesto of capitalism and general capitalist dynamics. And we know this because the media in Israel last fall announced that they were making a task force to intervene in affairs at colleges, universities throughout the U.S. And now we have the evidence of this actually happening. A couple of weeks ago, you saw the news about Eric Adams being in some phone chats with some Israeli millionaires and stuff like that. We know that Hochul was part of the Cuomo administration. They were very intertwined with the Israeli government. And we know that they have explicit instructions. And the problem here is the so-called liberals or Democrats just like to follow orders. They might not agree with it, but they just keep following orders. So that's why, for example, at the beginning, many of our higher-up authorities at CUNY thought that, oh, this is just an issue, you know, when people were denouncing Zionism. This is just an issue of free speech. And they changed their course to saying, like, no, this goes beyond free speech. Free speech will in no way defend this. And just example, we have a fellow colleague from the Latin American Studies Department who had been working for 20 years. And, you know, his activism didn't start or end in October 7th regarding Israel. He's also he's from the Bronx, and he shows his name. He also was intertwined with activism dealing with Puerto Rican situation. And because of a tweet, he was fired. He was just fired like that.
From CUNY.
Yeah.
Wow.
Or not reappointed, I guess, would be the...
He's an adjunct.
He can finish the semester. Yeah. He can finish the semester.
So because he does actions that a tenured professor would have, he can be basically shit-canned for his political speech.
Shit-canned. He's a scalp to show that they're doing their job when they have to answer back to whoever's up, who has shaken hands with the Zionist regime. In our case, as Caroline can talk more about, you know, we immediately acted on it. We denounced the president of the university. We directly confronted her. We're trying to organize other departments. We know the power that fear has in these situations. We've seen it before. We're seeing it again. So that's part of the one of many dimensions within CUNY.
Yeah, Carolyn, follow up on that, because now we're deep into CUNY territory, and people maybe aren't sure about the history of CUNY and its various different struggles over the years. So pick up on this thread. What if this isn't the only example of a sort of McCarthyite attack, right, on professors and students at CUNY and what you've been fighting against? Talk a little bit about it.
Well, certainly, yeah. I mean, I'm no historian of CUNY per se, but there, you know, it is a school with a very rough history. I can speak to this moment in particular being one in which, you know, that history, for example, like in the 70s when House Community College famously occupied the building during the austerity crisis of the 70s, where it was like, you know, the banks were the marionette controllers, and you know, CUNY was being gutted. It used to be free and it was going to be shut down, and they were shutting down schools, hospitals, all sorts of social services throughout the city. And the students and teachers of Hostos Community College occupied the building and refused to leave and succeeded. You know, Hostos is now actually, is still there very much so. And Danny Shaw actually also teaches at Hostos Community College in the Bronx. And so, yeah, I mean, CUNY has a radical history. It does stand, there has the encampments and the activism on campus has been amazing, but it has been pretty small compared to how large the nation is at CUNY. The silence in the rest of the faculty, or in much of the faculty, is sort of astounding in this moment, especially, you know, when there are, I mean, I guess I don't know the exact percentage of adjunct lecturers at the school, but, you know, if your job security could threaten after 20 years of service to the school for critiquing Zionism, which is an ideology that's dedicated to justice, John Jay specifically, and that's what we do in the classroom. We pull apart narratives. Students from all sorts of different backgrounds come to the school, and we discuss and we interrogate and we learn and we critique structures of oppression and injustice. And Zionism is, you know, a political movement that is, as Ian said, I think absolutely the enemy in what's going on in Gaza now and what has been happening in Palestine for decades. And, you know, if you can't critique in the university and instead the governor, you know, investigated the presence of anti-Semitism while, you know, also not being able to, you know, things that we sort of came up against when we confronted the president of the college about, you know, why this person was fired or not reappointed. We asked for a definition of anti-Semitism and a definition of Zionism. And she, you know, she didn't provide one because she's not a scholar and she can't define Zionism. Mm. You know, yet this concept and this ideology is being used now to repress speech and advocacy for justice against both students and faculty.
So, yeah, I'm looking at an article right now in The Gothamist, and it's about the beginning on October 31st, Governor Hochul stated that anti-Semitism had grown most acutely at CUNY, and as an inquiry after the attacks. I'm not the best alumnus. Like, I'll be the first to admit that I'm not going to, like, alumni events at Hunter College. It was in my past, and my Hunter experience was a wonderful one. But I will say, in October, I sent a strongly worded letter to the Hunter College alumni people, because, and you'll have to remind me, this was a minor scandal at the time. There was a documentary film that was going to be filmed at Hunter, that was going to be screened at Hunter College, which was about the Palestinian struggle. And if you don't know what it is, I'll have to look it up and make amendments to this episode. But long story short is they banned a film screening there. And I sent them a strongly worded letter and I said, this is not the Hunter College that I went to, which above all else is an extremely diverse student body representing, you know, in the population of New York City, which is extremely diverse with a lot of obviously leftist organizing, and the idea that they would shut down a film screening that's critical of Israel and critical of Zionism just really showed, I think, at an early date in this, last fall, how intense the backlash was going to be. And a backlash that I don't think any of us knew at the time, but two, three, four years ago, we saw with the campaign against Jeremy Corbyn within the Labour Party in the UK. That seemed like a particularly British scandal that they had, where advocacy for Palestinian rights is equated completely with anti-Semitism. But very quickly, of course, or at least over the course of several years, this has now hit the shores and completely redefined anti-Semitism in a way that I would have thought 10, 20 years ago was absurd and insane. And it now seems to be, from the governor to the president on down, the kind of working definition of anti-Semitism is standing up against the dispossession and oppression of the people of occupied Palestine.
Yeah, we have seen the attempts to codify it in the law. This equality between anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism was bent their knees on it, coming from both main political parties.
How have you faced it yourselves, Carol and Ian? Like, have you had any pressure upon yourselves with your act students affected by this?
Carolyn?
Well, yeah, you know, on one hand, having, of course, spoken about and dedicated to discussing what's happening in Gaza, which I think it's a responsibility to do that. Oh, otherwise, yeah. You run the risk of saying, okay, here, we're going to understand the world. We're understanding the economy. We're going to critique it, study it. But if you close the windows and doors so that you can't hear sort of the screams of what's happening outside, then how useful are the tools that you're learning and that you're honing?
Exactly.
And so, you know, we talk about, imperialism and settler colonialism, and it comes up. And so in those discussions, you know, students, there's a mix between, especially students that were already involved in SJP and the Arab Students Associate Union that are relieved and glad to be able to discuss this in class. I've been told many times that I'm is one of the only, not the only department on campus where professors have discussed this topic, even in class, even gratitude in bringing it into the classroom to discuss. And then there's also gratitude students who just knew nothing about it and kind of maybe vaguely saw on social media that there was something going on, but didn't know the backstory and the history. And so, you know, we're grateful to have a space created to discuss that. And then there's the third side of this, which is the, and this is a much smaller number, I will add, but the occasional Zionist student who doesn't want to talk, you know, feels uncomfortable participating in a discussion like that. But, that being said, I think for the most part, students are curious and excited to us things that are happening around them that are affecting them. But I've never, you know, I haven't experienced, I've brought my students to the town hall, for example, when we asked the president to speak on why this adjunct professor had not been reappointed, because I think it's important for them to see how this works. If they choose academia, are they going to study something that they care about? Are they going to pursue justice and investigate questions of justice? And then if they do that, if they choose to return to their alma mater, John Jay, will they be repressed or lose their job for investigating certain topics? And then, you know, if that's the case, can we highlight what are those topics that aren't allowed to be discussed? And so that's, you know, if anything, in my opinion, the classroom is an important place, or one of the most important places to be having, because even the students that come from Zionist backgrounds, and, you know, I will say Israel has one of the most powerful and sophisticated ideological sort of machines of kind of create globally. Global Zionist project, I think, is the right way to put it, because it really is somehow that narrative around, yeah, the consent for the horrific treatment of Palestinians and the annihilation of them is totally acceptable on a fundamental level. Under the Zionist narrative. And so that kind of consent, it fuses so deeply into people's self, into their identity. And so pulling something like that apart is a really delicate and sensitive thing to do. And so being able to do it in the classroom, I think enshrining and preserving the classroom is necessary, because, you know, how can we like learn about and understand justice if we can't look at ourselves also and have these moments where we investigate and maybe shift and change narratives that we receive growing up if they don't fit anymore with the information that we're learning about the world.
That's beautifully said. That's like a little endorsement of what I think a lot of people believe that the university should be, and in many cases over the last century or so has risen to. But I wonder, and this is a question for both of you, and maybe not even CUNY specific, but more broadly, what do you think the protest movement and the backlash and the free speech attacks within the university and the adjunctification of the university, what do all these say about what's happened to the university maybe in the last decades? Like, what are, like, this is a huge threat, obviously, to what's left of academic freedom, but it's kind of it exists alongside a lot of other longstanding threats, you know, to things like tenure, to the sense of the university as like a realm of self-governance by, you know, teaching people for teaching people. It seems like more and more this kind of donor endowment, and CUNY probably doesn't have a huge endowment, if any, but this kind of the pressure of the endowments and the donors, what that's been doing to the university and how this is a reflection of it.
Yeah, just to give you a very recent, and it's important because the graduation is on Tuesday, told he's going to be there, but Chuck Schumer, some weeks ago, they finally announced that, Carolyn, do you remember how much money it was? It was like $900,000.
Wasn't it close to $1 million?
Yeah, close to $1 million to develop some cybersecurity lab at John Jay.
Okay.
And that's coming in towards us, John Jay, as part of CUNY, in a situation where right now legal aspects of what is and what isn't free speech, that title, it's called title, I don't remember what it is.
Yeah,
explicitly talks about funding of public institutions that can be taken away. Mm. And we're talking about a situation in which CUNY, as you said, doesn't have big donors, doesn't have a big endowment, clearly celebrates any instance of when monetary support is given. And in this particular case, I think it's clear to see that there are threats attached to the money, or potential threats attached to the money. And that was the basis of the president of the university, Carol Mason, to tell us precisely why she decided to reappoint the adjunct. Because she made, what was the statement she made? Not cost benefit. She said some risk, whatever.
A risk assessment.
Risk assessment. Sounds very corporate.
Yeah, sounds very corporate. Exactly. And of course, her decision was to accept the money and fire Danisha.
Of course.
So we're in that precarious situation where money and access to money and funding is the main lever for taking decisions within the university, which of course have political dimensions to it that are extremely, extremely explicit. So, and that's part of, you know, the rise of bureaucracy in universities, administrative pace, money being used to pay for, you know, look at our website, the John Jay website is costs a ton of money and it's completely useless. So it's from the small biggest things, we see these misappropriations and this mismanagement of money. But I mean, mismanagement from our perspective, not from their perspective.
Well, from their perspective, you need to provide all sorts of like middle management type positions to people. So like they can bureaucrats can feed off the system, right? So that there can be these jobs. And there, of course, too, is, and this is due to larger changes in society, that kind of HRification of the university as well, where like safetyism comes in and free speech gets wrapped up into like, you know, are people being offended? There's feelings involved. And of course, whether the like right or left, we've seen a huge swing in this where like a Zionist student can be made to feel unsafe, confronted with facts on the ground in Gaza. So it seems like we've got like, There's a heady brew right now of confusion and conflict happening in the university that it seems is due to like these massive changes that you're talking about.
Yeah, and in the case of John Jay, remember that I've been told that to this day the NYPD thinks that John Jay is still their college.
Right.
And think about the relationship between that NYPD cop training.
Yeah, that's a real thing.
So all of those ingredients are cooking there, in which is a long history, as you were talking about, a long history between, you know, the state apparatus and the progressive forces in what used to be a story of trying to develop the university that's accessible to the working class of New York City.
Yes. Carolyn, follow up.
Well, yeah, and I think it also relates to this taking of all of things that should be like education and with No Child Left Behind in the early 2000s into this business model where, okay, we're going to pay for it, but you know, it's the austerity language. It's, we're going to pay for it, but you have to make it worth our while. You have to show us that our investment, that we're going to get results from our investment. And I said, well, what does that mean? You're educating people. Like, how can you possibly quantify and put on a balance sheet the benefits of providing education for a society? But nonetheless, that totally dominates the funding paradigm. And it puts universities at, you know, and makes them completely vulnerable to the same thing that our entire democracy is vulnerable to, which is just the capitalists wielding power and the money that they and the resources that they have and making everything else fall in lockstep.
Absolutely. Has Cyrus told you about the project that we're working on right now, the Independent Lyric Club of New York?
A little bit.
Yeah. A little bit, yeah.
What were... You know, the university is an interesting thing because we're looking to like a couple steps back from, let's say, sectarian Marxist or leftist organizing on the one hand, but also like activism broadly conceived on the other, trying to find a way to build some sort of like institution basis for working class interests broadly conceived. Trying to focus on civil society, right, which is to say like independent institutions, the market, of course, being one of them, right, that exist outside and are often in conflict with the state. And the universities, of course, as we know, especially the private ones, kind of still have this aura as independent bases of power within civil society. And you see this when, of course, in Columbia, when the arrests. And I think, what was the college where they assaulted like an older woman who was a professor? I forget which.
Emory.
You have all these instances where a lot of the conflict is around like, how does this self-governing like private institution deal with things happening internally that they claim that they can't sort out? So calling the police in from the outside goes to show the sort of what's left of civil social nature of these institutions. But more and more we see, as with the rest of civil society, that these independent institutions are more and more suborned to not just capital, but of course also the state and state interests and whatnot. So like the university and its decline, let's just say, and I'm not talking about CUNY here, I'm talking about all universities there, the rise of this kind of administrative case of the actual institution of learning and things of that sort. The university is kind of a test case for, or an example of, let's say, what needs to be fought against, what needs to be built around if we're going to make the working class broadly conceived in the United States and elsewhere like an institutional force again that can actually express its interests. So that's a long-winded way of saying, you know, the university obviously is this site of struggle that exists. It's got the residue of a sort of like high-minded freedom of speech and also freedom of inquiry and discussion that is slowly being eroded. And I wonder if like the battle for the university that's going on right now isn't an extremely important battle for the working class broadly conceived in order to have its say, any say left in the broader society, the capitalist society.
That's a heck of a topic, my friend.
Yeah, I just opened that up like 45 minutes into the episode. Get my head than anything else. But
can I ask you a question, Sean?
Yeah, please.
Let's reverse roles here.
Yeah.
Because I'm really interested in this and I don't know much about it. Like, because sometimes we tend to also romanticize the university, because we're trying to save the little we have, but at the same time, we also want to transform it and change it. So, you know, when I think of the university, I think of Herrick, I think of the Board of Trustees. I think about, you know, this issue of those that have power don't have power because they follow orders from the people that they represent, but from even foreign elements. University, we saw it here. I think it was with Columbia just 2 weeks ago. They gave names and the backgrounds of the people who are the board of trustees over there and the relationship to the industrial military complex and papa.
Yeah.
So how do you have any particular models that you see to compare or experiences here in the U.S.? Well, this is a hell of a topic.
It's a huge topic. I think maybe in the education discussion, the best way to think about this would be to take several steps back and say, if the working class itself were to have an institution of education, if it were to have its ability to produce and reproduce on its own, in its own interest, what might that look like? And we have plenty of examples from the Social Democratic Party of Germany in the 19th century to in the United States, we have the Knights of Labor and the early AFL and certainly the CIO later on, having sort of conveyor belts of knowledge going back and forth between, the rank and file members of the class and then what existed in terms of its independent organizations. It's a daunting thing to imagine what a working class university would look like. But I think a very important question, which is do we take, and you address this too, I think, in your work, it's how do we take these rarefied ideas that exist up in the academy? And how do we take the realm of political action, such as it exists in the United States? How do we take people who are confused about the world, but have a sense that there's a deep injustice. How do we connect these things all together in such a way that our ideas aren't just abstractions floating around and disembodied ideas? What would it mean to create a body politic that could fill these disembodied ideas with some actual activity, practical activity? And I think that then education, the university is obviously part of that to the extent that you at CUNY or anybody in a private or public institution can try to democratize and can try to fill the curriculum with the sort of things necessary for the working class to stand on its own. But then maybe also too, we need to look at the limitations of these institutions as imbued and obviously existing within the capitalist format. And imagine if Karen and you and myself and others were to craft an educational institution, what that might look like, and then compare that to what we have today. I don't know. It's a huge question. Carolyn, what do you think?
Well, I think, it is an interesting topic. I think it also might be a good thing to talking a little bit about maybe the history of the economics department.
Yes,
if you're still
please.
Up to going there, Ian. But, but I also think, maybe just before that, I would just say that the university has changed even in the past 50 years a lot. It's very expensive and it's become more dependent on, it's in this kind of patronage structure. I guess I'm wondering if you're talking about starting a separate institution where you're okay, we're going to do this again in a different way, or if you're go from it with, inside how it already exists and carving out space, be really forward and direct with what it is that you're trying to address and critique and discuss. And I think John Jay and also UMass Amherst where Ian went is a good example of the latter.
Yeah.
Because, it was an institution that in the Ian, maybe you want to tell the story. I don't want to mess it up.
Yeah. Tell us the history of UMass Amherst.
Well, before that, I was going to say that what you guys were 1970s at CUNY probably is the last time we had this big discussion about the university when there were discussions about open admissions.
Yeah.
Which, of course, all of that happened. The struggles were in May of 69, I think it was, and open admission started that same fall or 70, I can't remember. But that all came to an end with the fiscal crisis of New York.
So
we speak about alternatives, we need to speak about funding when we speak. I don't know if you guys want to talk about dual power, but we have to.
Certainly the students with their occupations of hostess and the City University of New York had a giant occupation as well, if I recall. Not that I was alive back then, but from what I've read about.
Yeah.
There is you know, at the heart of this is sort of competing, a conflict of interest between the students and what they want to get and their voices on the one hand, the university on the other. And as Carolyn pointed out, the last 50 years have been such that the latter has won out against the former. So UMass Amherst, give us a potted history.
Well, I guess I should say that most of our tenure, let's say, fellow colleagues at John Jay, all come from institutions that we would classify now as Seattle's economics departments, which there are five or six in the United States as a whole. And UMass in 1973 became probably the most important one. Because in no time, they suddenly got together a package of five radical political economists that got hired together. And this is more or less, not the height of the Cold War, but, you know, more or less.
Yeah.
Very contested times. And it had a time when there was an expansion in public higher education. So this is about different things combining, you know, history works. And the thing that was working for them was the fact that all people that were hired actually came from the elite universities. So when I say elite, I mean Yale, MIT, Harvard. So they had the academic pedigree. And the college was interested. They wanted to expand enrollment. The professors that they had hired before with huge reputation, one of them even won a Nobel Prize, were clearly terrible in the classroom. So the economic department was in a crisis. And long story short, they hired Sam Bowles from Harvard, and he's the one that put the package together. Now, at the same time, great coincidences happen. Another person that was hired, they thought he was a mainstream economist, Leonard Rapping. But at the time, because of the Vietnam War, his ideology had changed. He had become progressive, left, and they know this. So officially, they hired five radicals, and then unofficially, they hired six. But then on top of that, Rapping wanted also a former student of his to get hired. So he pushed for that, and because they were looking for, I think they hired in the span of 4 years, like 13, 14, 15 economists, something like that. So at that time, that was possible. At the time, the people hired were men, white, American. That there were no females or non-Americans available, but that's how it played out. Some people say it was because of the pedigree, that if this was going to fly, they needed that background. So nobody, you know, down the line coming from the state would put questions about, you know, I don't know, just being trained in Western Massachusetts or some shit like that. But it attracted a huge amount of students. And there, let's connect it now to CUNY. An important variable there is that those first classes of students that applied, many of them came from CUNY, because even though those five professors that originally were hired came from the Ivy League universities, two of them were teaching at City College. Those were the Reagan Wolf that you had mentioned before. So, of course, they were very popular teachers all their lives, and they attracted some of their students from CUNY. And these are the same students that had the activist experience of the late 60s, early 70s. So that also helped the attempt to build a program, and the fact that if you're a person going to economics to get a degree, usually these people apply to the important departments, the ones with a name. Whereas if you're interested in radical political economics, why the hell would you apply to MIT or Harvard or Yale? So there was a process of self-selection that worked on par. So clearly, you know, you had to take a GRE exam and be compared to everybody else. But, you know, people did well. And suddenly in the span of, I think it was 2 years, according to the official accounts, basically most of the students at the graduate level became were interested in radical political economy and Marx. And then they also tried to transform the undergraduate curriculum, I would say not very effectively, but whatever, to try and reflect the pluralism, the fact that there's many schools of thought that try to represent the capitalist reality in their own way. Something that if you come out of any other university, you would have no idea. So, for example, courses in the history of economic thought or economic history are not very common for people to take in those departments. On the contrary, you're expected to become more of a technocrat. go take classes in the math department, you know, in the most abstract types of analysis and quantitative studies and stuff like that. Yeah. Whereas here, yeah, we're interested in stuff as well. And we're interested in science and the philosophy of science, but we want also to, you know, talk about other disciplines, and those disciplines also represented from other parts of the world. So that's something that I really, really gained from. And again, some projects at UMass Boston and ours at John Jay College, these are just the children of UMass Amherst in that sense. And so we learned a lot from them, and we hope not to repeat the mistakes and hopefully push our agenda in this new changed historical situation.
So not everything over the last 50 years has been bad in the university, and now we've got John Jay College and the economics department there. So you kind of took a hint from the Amherst experience, and you said 2016 your program came together, is that right?
Oh, the in terms of the history of John Jay College, the modern version, there was an economics department in the 70s, but after the fiscal crisis there was a restructuring. Broke it up and sent economists to participate and provide service courses in other departments. But the modern history of this department starts in 2008. Professor Joan Hoffman and Professor Jay Hamilton basically pushed forth to the rebuilding of a new independent economics program. And that happened in 2008. And in 2009, they got permission to hire two or three hires. All of them actually ended up being from UMass Amherst. And then they did the unthinkable, which was to change their graduate economics curriculum. So right now, our undergraduate students have, as a required class, they have to read Volume 1 of Capital.
Okay.
So notice that this is not people interested in Marxism that want to take a class with David Harvey in the Graduate Center. These are people that probably have no idea about Marxism. They come from a working class background.
Absolutely.
And as part of their formal studies, they have to be exposed to probably the most important critical mind regarding capitalism.
Well, that's a win right there. Yeah, I think I'll leave things because we're at about an hour right now. Maybe like the broader question is unanswerable about what the kind of unity of the work you do with, say, the unity of what trade unions and like independent groups like the ILC do. It's an open question about how these two things can be married together. And I think it's one that we all need to work out ourselves. We need to experiment with. But I think that it's a really important question that everybody out there should be thinking about, because, you know, I don't think it's an either or proposition, right? Nobody I know has the resources to have like a huge undergraduate program where you have to recapital Volume 1. But I think that what the John Jay program does, and this is evident in all of the struggle and conflict that's happened in the university, is to, in that format and in the broader political format, try to bring these ideas to life with the sort of activism and protest and free engagement of ideas that you too and many, many others in the CUNY world have been trying to do recently. So I wonder, maybe as we kind of tail off on this episode, what you think the future is. What does the future hold for your department? What does the future hold, you think, in the Gaza protests that are happening right now? What does the future hold for yourselves?
Well, I think if I could maybe just quickly try to respond to that question, I think it actually maybe is a bit, because if you look at just the history of economics as a discipline and that lack of self-awareness and self-reflection and, you know, conspicuous of teaching the history of economic thought, you could look at it as a kind of erasure, censorship, or repression of Marx, which, you know, as he insists, one of the most important critical minds in terms of people looking at capitalism and trying to understand and make sense of it. So the surprising, considering how prolific he was and how, you know, he brought in this question of domination and class struggle into the analysis of capitalism, considering the fact that that's absent from the discipline, and then looking at what's happening at John Jay, how powerful it is just to bring his voice back in. The student a semester reading Capital, and it's embedded in their understanding of how the economy works and how capitalism works. Just including that voice, we've seen, is so powerful in terms of, you know, raising their consciousness and awareness of how systems of domination work in our economy, and kind of immediately pops the balloon of this like hamster wheel that we're all otherwise turning on, where it's like, oh yeah, capitalism is natural. One day I'm going to ascend to the top. It's a meritocracy. I'm going to make it. It's going to be great. You know, and it's not the result from what I've seen in the short amount of time that I've been at John Jay is it's not apathy that ends from that. It's which we, I think, often see in the kind of, you know, because Marxism taught in school, we know there is this like alternative culture of trying to read Marx and understand it outside of the just learning about the economy,
right.
Which is great. But when it's present in that context, I think there's so much potential and possibility for what can emerge from that. And it doesn't necessarily just have to be this disaffected kind of very common millennial attitude where it's like, oh, well, I see it. I'm disillusioned. It's pointless. I'm not even going to try. But actually, there become so many different, you know, infinite, unimaginable possibilities of how people can use their energy to try and effect change instead of continuing under this sort of sleepy illusion. And so, you know, I think, especially because we're talking about Gaza and censorship and region, I think it's very powerful what can happen when you look at the repressed or marginalized or censored voices and bring them back into the conversation and then just kind of spin it like a top and see what happens. I don't think it has to be such a concerted, directed, prescriptive program in that sense.
Very, very eloquent. Again, we're going to have you back on. You guys just got all banger on this topic. Ian, maybe you want to close us out with some final thoughts about, what's happening with the protests and what's happening at John Jay in the future.
Following Carolyn, let's not forget our students are the working class of New York City,
right.
Which means that we are in constant learning from them. And when we teach Marx, for example, in some senses, we're not teaching them something new. We're just trying to organize coherently what they suffer and experience every day. Mm-hmm. And in terms of the current context of what's happening, let's not forget that many of those students are also involved in struggles within the union movement, where you have this rank and file trying to contest its bureaucratic leadership in terms of what positions to take in the situation in Gaza, in a situation where in the United States, what seems to be one of the most fastest moving political entities is precisely maybe the rebuilding of working class institutions. In a scenario where historically, at least, many of us, especially coming from the third world, have always been suspicious about certain unions and their roles transnationally.
AFL, but either CIA, way,
yeah, exactly. The AFL-CIA, let's call it. But as Karen says, one thing that students, working class students, without a doubt express is empathy, without a doubt. And for us, then, the struggle is not only to get them out of this individualist way of thinking, but also the way of thinking that frames things in terms of the nation state.
Mm.
Right? And that's a real, real challenge in economics because, you know, the types of economics that people like is like things like macroeconomics. And what is macroeconomics about? Well, the unit of analysis is the nation state, you know, the growth rate of this country versus the growth rate of the other one, the employment rate and this and that. And that does shape how people perceive themselves and reality. There's no doubt about that. I mean, remember that book of Benedict Anderson, Imagine Communities.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that elites know this, and they actively intercede to shape how people, you know, visualize reality. In the case of Puerto Rico, again, politics has been defined in terms of the colonial relationship, as if all Puerto Ricans, we all have to gain, we all can benefit from independence, but, you know, all is too many people.
Yeah.
I don't want to ally myself with certain elements of Puerto Rican society.
Yeah, and the high rises of San Juan, right? There's people that yes. I should not be allied with.
Yes, yes. So, again, it's for us, it's a huge learning experience. You know, we're updating our ways of seeing the world with our interactions with our students every day. And I think that, you know, we have to look at the positive side of this catastrophe, which is that, again, this is part of the long catastrophe of capitalism, that the ideological spectrum has opened up a lot. You know, the more the scientists open their mouth and the more we see on the news, it's like, you know, this, the defenses for that genocidal ideology are falling.
Well, also very eloquent. I tell you, by way of thanks, I, through my union pension, retire in about 15 years, and it's been about 15 years since I've been at Hunter College. So stick around at John Jay for about a decade and a half. And maybe when I retire, I'll take some classes under the two of you.
Come over, please.
But in the meantime, anybody...
Take or give classes.
Anybody who's interested, we'll put the links, obviously, to the program in. I think you're doing great work, both of you, in so many spheres right now. And thank you for the great podcast appearance. You guys are awesome. Any parting words?
Thank you to the Antifada podcast for this space, and hopefully it can repeat itself.
I agree.
Yeah, thank you so much for having
Thank you. All right. Have a great one. Thanks again for listening, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And just when you thought we were gone, we're back. It turns out that we did rep the master's program. So, Carolyn, description and why people should join up.
Yeah, I mean, mentioning the vibrant culture, especially I know in New York City, of Peterson Marx and studying and about his ideas, I think, and generally the economy, politics, any intersection of, you know, power, class struggle, CUNY and the program at John Jay in the econ department, very affordable, very fun, so very rigorous. So, yeah, I mean, I was in my 20s wondering, you know, this labor market is unique, terrible. I wonder what I'm trying to look at. But all I can see is this sort of mist. I have all of these curiosities. I want to continue my studies. And so I jumped from anthropology to economics because I had kind of encountered it towards the end of my education. But I didn't have that much of a background in economics. I was working as a math tutor for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I joined the master's program at John Jay in 2020. And it's just such a wonderful place to study and talk and, you know, converse with people about things. And it's a great way to engage with these topics and these ideas. And the faculty is amazing. And everyone is very, you know, pursuing very interesting work. It's also like, you would be surprised how many different approaches to this can emerge and how, like, different people have different ideas around this stuff. And so it's a great place to sort of have that discussion. And accepting applicants for the fall. And you can email questions about that, I believe. Did I leave anything out, Ian?
Yeah, great. You have till the beginning of August to send your applications. Very simple. You don't have to take any tests or anything. Find three people who can recommend you. They don't have to be former teachers. At least one of them hopefully is. It can be your boss, a family member, whatever, somebody you shared some experiences with. Write a little statement of purpose where you tell us why you want to be part of the John Jay Economics Master's Program. And, of course, transcripts. And if you have any questions, I think, Sean, you're going to put a link or something to the website. You can contact me. Don't hesitate. And I'll try to answer your questions as quickly as possible.
Talk about an interactive experience now. You're going from listening to the podcast to, I'll put the link to Ian's contact in there, and you can interact with him. And I amend my former plan. So I said, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to take some classes in 15 years. I am going to ask all of you out there, if you're going to join the economics program at John Jay College, the master's program, stay there for at least 15 or 16 years before you graduate. And then you and I can be there together. It'll be a lot of fun. So this is awesome. Thank you again, guys. And we'll, like I said, put all those links in. And if you're interested in the program, you should definitely apply. And then we'll all hang out. It'll be a great time.
And definitely come to the event on June 8th.
Yes, June 8th.
Talk very about important. It. Before breaking out your transcript. Yeah. We'll both be there and any kinds of questions that anyone has.
Our department, we like music, we like to play games, so it's way beyond, you know, the standard stuff.
So a new city, show up. If you're in Jersey or Connecticut, you're going to have to maybe take a train or drive, but you know what? That's what you got to do. The struggle continues. For a new